This is an RSA podcast. RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Today, I have left the mainland to endure a very choppy but fortunately short trip to meet one of the country's leading theatre designers. Timothy O'Brien has been strutting the boards since the early 1950s. With no formal art training, he began designing productions whilst up at Cambridge, where he read history. After completing a fellowship at Yale University in the United States, he returned to England to embark on a 10-year stint in television, where he eventually had overall responsibility for ABC's entire drama output. This led him to what was to become his first love, the theatre. And since those early years, he has clocked up 119 theatrical productions, and 25 of those were for the Royal Shakespeare Company. He has worked with some of the giants of modern theatre, from Peter Hall to Harold Pinter, and John Gielgud to Samuel Beckett, and along the way has won many awards. When I spoke to him, he was in the final stages of the design for the third in Wagner's epic Ring cycle, Siegfried, with long-term collaborator and director Graham Vick. Next year, 2009, we'll see the completion of The Ring, with Götterdämmerung, the premiere of which will coincide with Timothy O'Brien's 80th year. I spoke to him at his home on the Isle of Wight. Well, it's 2008, and we're sitting in your beautiful and newly completed home here on the Isle of Wight in this hour or so that we've got. I want to kind of work my way through that journey. I'd like to go back to the beginning. You were born in India in the same year as the Wall Street crash, as it happened. So it was quite a dramatic time. What are your memories of India as a small child? Do you have any?
Well, I do. I was four on the boat coming home, but I do remember something of India. My father was a soldier, and I used to see the life of the regiment around me. I can remember physical things. I can remember rutted roads filled with water. I can remember, though it may be that I've been reminded, a black panther crossing the road in front of our car. I can remember the river steamers on the Brahmaputra, particularly beautiful with their lights on at night. So I think that was a rich set of memories, and I came home because that's what you had to do. You had to come home in those days when you were about four so that you could be brought up in England. And I was brought up, in fact, by my grandparents, who were very good to me.
So your parents stayed in India, didn't they?
Yes, and I didn't see my mother and father very much. When the war came, just before the war, my father had a posting to the India office in London. And so I saw him for a while then. My mother never went back to India after that. The war broke out whilst he was at the India office, but then he went away to the war. So I think I saw very little of my father for much of my life. And people sometimes say, well, wasn't that rather a pity? Well, but it was just natural. It's what people who had family in India experienced. And my mother's family had served in India for generations. It was entirely understood that you would be sent home and looked after by foster parents. In fact, there's a very famous Kipling story called Bar Bar Black Sheep, which is an unhappy story. My story was happy.
And when you say school here, were you sent away to school? Or?
Yes, I went to a prep school when I was eight. I was rather unhappy at that because at home everything revolved around me and at school it didn't. And then I went to a public school at the age of 13 to 18, which was more interesting because I was further developed.
Of course. And then you went into the army.
I went into the army necessarily on national service, and I went to Austria in the intelligence corps and had a pretty interesting time because it hadn't been possible to go abroad before the war. And here I was in Austria doing an interesting job in the intelligence corps and wearing civilian clothes much of the time. And from Austria, it was possible for me to go on leave with a friend of mine in the army to Venice and Florence. And Venice and Florence in 1948. Oh,
wow.
Wonderful.
I can imagine.
They were so pleased to see you because the English had been very popular in Italy before the war, and they hadn't seen anybody from England for a long time, and you'd fall into conversations with Italians, and it was clear that you were very welcome. And you could sit in a cell in St. Mark's Convent in Florence, looking at the Fra Angelicos, and you could sit in a cell probably for 3/4 of an hour without anybody else looking into the cell where you were gazing at the Annunciation on the wall.
Mm. Oh, that's wonderful, that's wonderful. And so you then finished your period in just a little under 2 years in the army, and you came back to go up to Cambridge.
Yes, where I read history in part one and English in part two. But what I really did there, of course, was to take up a suggestion that my mother had made to me some time before when she saw that I was interested in drawing and painting at school, that I should take up theatre design. So I arrived in Cambridge, very naive, but absolutely hell-bent on being a theatre designer. And it just so happens, and luck plays a very great part in people's lives, that Peter Hall and John Barton and other people of consequence in the theatre were at Cambridge with me. So we started out together, and I did Shakespeare plays at Cambridge, and I found it really exciting. And there was a great tradition there. The Marlowe Society had a great tradition, and the ADC, the Amateur Dramatic Club at Cambridge, had a great tradition. So it was possible, through the leniency of my college authorities, to design shows throughout my Cambridge career, which meant that when my Cambridge career came to an end and I wondered what I would do at that point, I was able to go in for a fellowship at Yale University, a Henry Fellowship, which was open to anybody in any subject under the age of 26 in the British Commonwealth.
Mm.
And I think I got that fellowship quite undeservedly because my métier was so unexpected. And it was an interview. You didn't have to show that you were good at anything. You just had to talk a blue streak.
And that led you to Yale, of course, and a revelation of being in America and soaking up all of that culture.
It wasn't so much the culture, Mike. It was the fact of the place.
Yes.
I can't tell you how exciting it is to be on the deck early in the morning of the old Queen Elizabeth and see the towers of Manhattan rising out of the sea. To enter a country which was then very much like the covers of Saturday Evening Post, where many of you looked exactly like Edward Hopper, and where, if you like, the star of the place was its vastness and the variety of its landscape. And I bought a car for just $300, and I drove it all the way across the north of the United States with little journeys, side journeys into Canada. And when I got to the far side, I sold it for the same amount of money that I'd paid for it and bought a big Greyhound ticket, a really big Greyhound ticket, and went all the way down the west coast of America, all the way across the deep south, and up into the New England states again. It was a magnificent journey. And again, it wasn't very cultural. It was more immersion in the place and its people.
Yes. And then you came back to the UK and, of course, you had the big problem of actually getting a job.
That's right. And that wasn't easy because at that time, the English theatre was not a very welcome place. It was divided, roughly speaking, into the West End and the provinces. And the provincial repertories were dangerous places to work in. You had to work for very little money, astonishingly long hours, very little professional satisfaction, a very hard school, which crushed a lot of people. The West End was quite understandably and quite pardonably the province of a small circle of people who were all connected socially. Some of these people, designers that is, were extremely gifted, but they were social animals in a particular swim. And for a young person, it was really inconceivable that we would walk into that world and make easy progress. In fact, even when I did my first West End show, real West End show for H.M. Tennant, I designed Peter Schaffer's Five-Finger Exercise, directed by John Gielgud.
Mm.
I found it quite a harrowing experience because they were all so knowing. And I think they thought of me as, they probably thought of me as rather ignorant and certainly not aware of the social currents that governed their life. I took my portfolio of work and I went to see prominent people, people who ran the Old Vic, people who ran Stratford. I think I even showed my work to someone at Covent Garden. I made the rounds. I was very politely received, but there was never any prospect that they would actually give me work because I hadn't done anything in their terms. So I wondered what to do, and I found myself to be singularly unqualified. And I went around the advertising agencies, and the advertising agencies looked at my work and they found it very unreliable. I mean, they weren't interested in renderings of theatre sets and costumes.
What did you think you would get from advertising agencies? I mean, did you literally think you'd money. Just get a job as just illustrating for ads?
Eventually, I did get a job in Mazer and Crowther.
Oh, yes.
And I heard the man saying to the group leader, when he had said, OK, you come and work here for £6 a week, I heard him saying to the group leader, well, at least he's expensively educated. And I found myself sitting at a desk, laboriously writing the word cod and the figures 2 shillings and 9 pence. And I did this without any real distinction for a while. But of course, at the same time, I was looking out for opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And I got an opportunity because I went to... I happened to know, through a family connection, a designer who worked for BBC Television. And he suggested that I should go and see Richard Levin, RDI,
mm-hmm.
who was the he was the head of design at BBC Television. And he had come into BBC Television with a mission to improve the standards of design in their department, because it was, broadly speaking, populated by people who had had perhaps a small role to play in the British film industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was on the lookout for people who were going to work as he wanted people to work, rather than work the way that people had been used to working up to then, which was in a way a recipe for unpopularity, because he grabbed me and he grabbed another person called Tony Abbott, who became an RDI, and said, in effect, to all the people who were there, well, these people are going to show you up. Well, A, we were incompetent, and B, that was not the way to launch us in this little community. The BBC design department at that time was only 23 people strong.
Yes.
Eventually became hundreds of people,
yes.
But then it was very small. And, of course, I could only really expect to work as an assistant, and I don't like assisting people. So I was bolshy, ignorant, and difficult.
And lasted a year, I think.
Oh, no, that's not the way to look at it.
Well, probably absorbed, perhaps.
No, it's that I had the great good fortune to arrive and get a little bit of experience and then to find that independent television was starting.
Yes.
And anybody with even a speck of experience was immediately able to move to a better position.
Yes.
And better pay.
Yes.
And I was, first of all, in a television company called Associated Rediffusion,
yes.
for a little while.
Yes.
And then I got an opportunity to become the head of design of ABC Television. And that was a real education.
Well, that was a 10-year period as well. I mean, it was a long period of time, during which, as head of design, you were responsible for some 70 drama productions. And the thing that amazed me is that during that period you also seemed to manage to do quite a lot of external productions.
It's a pleasure to remember how liberal those days were. First of all, the people who ran independent television were completely taken aback by the amount of money they made.
Mm.
It gave them... They were new to the business. They were making inordinate sums of money. They had no sense of the dangers. It gave them quite a liberal attitude. You would ask for your budgets in your work to be increased, they would increase them. you would say that it was going to be their benefit if you worked in other fields whilst you were working for them. They would allow you to do that. You would say to them that you wanted to create your department by picking everybody that worked in it yourself without any thought of what other people might think. There was enormous freedom of action. And since I couldn't do all the shows myself, I wanted to pick people to work with me whom I liked.
Sure.
And I felt I appreciated their qualities. And I was able to build up a group of people, eventually about 40 strong. And all of them were people that I wanted to work with. And I was absolutely intent on protecting them from the commercial imperatives. Towards the end of the 10 years, the commercial imperative started to appear. But I was always very insistent that the design department at ABC Television should be independent, driven by enlightened self-interest, and allowed to do good work.
And I would have imagined that quite a lot of the productions during that period would have been, well, quite possibly live.
Yes, we started out without any form of recording, so they were live. And there were some fairly spectacular disasters. People on a crane making a quick move, catching their elbow on a doorway, and the camera spinning unexpectedly through 360 degrees.
But I guess that, you know, having been responsible for, as you say, you obviously designed a fraction of them, but nevertheless, responsibility for 70 dramas.
I designed them because there were many. I designed an enormous amount.
Yes.
But there was an enormous amount to design.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in 10 years, 70 productions is a hell of a lot.
Yes.
And if you add on to that the 23 productions that you were
doing outside.
Moonlighting on that.
Well, it wasn't moonlighting. Well, it was all very creditable.
Very kosher. But I mean, the point I'm making is, I'm sure that they're very demanding. I mean, just working on a single production, I'm sure, is very demanding because
there was an immensely swift turnover. You learnt by being under real pressure. You'd receive a script, you'd go through it with the director, you'd design the layout of the studio, you'd start to make arrangements for the scenery to be built, you'd go into rehearsal. You'd go up to Manchester and rehearse the show in the studio. The show would be transmitted, and then you'd be immediately the following day starting on the next one. So it was a kind of, I would have thought it was around about a 6-week turnover.
And during that period, or towards the end of that period, a couple of years before you left the television company, one of the productions that you were responsible for was Waiting for Godot, of course. Now, I know that that had been performed before, but this was the Royal Court production in 1964 with Anthony Page directing, but also with Beckett himself there in a sort of advisory capacity, from what I understand. And I would have thought that was quite a special experience, and I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that production and your role in it, your relationship.
It taught me an enormous amount, and I might as well tell you the story. In 1964, I had to go to America for 3 weeks, and when I got back, I found that a production of Great Expectations I'd been preparing for the Royal Court had been replaced by Waiting for Godot. I was a bit surprised, but I said, well, that's a good play. And because there wasn't much time, the director, Anthony Page, suggested that I design a couple of versions of the set in model form and send photographs of them to the author in Paris. I did so and waited. By return, I received a postcard. The 4th of December, 1964, Paris. Dear Mr. O'Brien, thanks for the photos. All much too big and real. Faint tree upstage actors left, faint stone downstage actors right, faint path between. Uninscribed sky and distance, evening light, emptiness at all costs. For tree see text, please don't start construction till I get over, shall be in the theatre next Thursday morning. Sincerely, Samuel Beckett.
Now, how did you feel about that? It was a very dictatorial postcard, very concise. How did you feel about that, having had the experience of, you know, you clocked up 100 or so productions by that time? I'm sure you felt you knew what you were doing.
Oh, I don't think I felt that. I responded to the postcard in haste and built a new model which had as high a standard of abstinence as I could then manage. And on that Thursday, I took it along to a small office high in the theatre, lit by pale winter sunshine. The door opened and Beckett stepped into the light. He looked like an eagle and he was mesmerising. Mr. Beckett, it's just that in this theatre there's a large recess on actors' left from which Lucky and Pozzo can emerge. Oh, sure, it's the wrong way round, but maybe no harm will come of that. Time passed and we were ready to go on stage and I waited for his reaction. And he says, "What's the stone made from?" And I say, "Plaster." And he says, "Ah, it should be stone, cut, so that we can see what it is." And I remember taking my Renault 4 to a derelict area in Southwark, now I'm sure sumptuously refurbished, and picking up a curb edge, which depressed the Renault noticeably. And I got the stone onto the stage, where it fitted nicely. Beckett looked again. "What's the path made from?" "Plaster, Sam," I said. "We're getting along by then." How high is it?" "Oh, 4 inches maximum. Shall I take it away?" "Would you do that?" When it was gone, the stage cloth bore a beautiful scar. Sam looked at it appreciatively in silence. "About the tree." "Shall we go and talk to the tree?" I said. He smiled, and we climbed on stage. "It's too tall. Shall we cut it there?" he said, pointing to a place which wasn't very high above the stage. I said, "Well..." reaching up on tiptoe, "shall we cut it there?" "All right," he said, to a point halfway in between. "Here then." He paused, looking directly at me, and said, "My last tree was by Giacometti."
Well, there's a man who knew exactly what he wanted.
Yes, and I can tell you what it was like. I can tell you what it was like, and it's had a very strong influence on what I've done since. It was extremely painful. I felt very compressed by the process. I realized that he was not only wanting exactly what he was wanting, but he was wanting only what the play needed and nothing else. And so I found that very chastening in the best sense.
Well, I think you actually said... about designing for the editor, that the aim is clarity and the enemy is distraction. And it seemed to me that little conversation you had with Beckett, it was very much centred around those very things. He knew exactly what was necessary to leave out.
Yes, he had, as my family had, but in different terms, a very strong sense of form.
Mm.
His writings may seem to people who are coming to them for the first time obscure, difficult to understand, but in themselves they're extremely clear and very beautifully constructed. And I remember him saying something when I was working on that production and we were talking about the clothes, which always, it was a very simple remark, but it always stayed in my mind. I said, "Why does Estragon wear boots?" And he said, "Because he takes them off in the second act."
Mm. Let's move over now to Shakespeare, because of his 37 plays, you've actually designed 17, but you've been responsible for 25 productions, and you've had a long association with the Royal Shakespeare Company. So I'd just be interested to know what effect, you know, Shakespeare has had on you, what he means to you, because that's a formidable amount of productions, which means that you've become very intimate with one particular playwright. Could we just talk a little bit about that man and his effect on you?
Well, we could talk a little bit about the change that I had to go through when I moved out of ABC television. I had the great good fortune, when I felt it was time to move on, to have the patronage of Peter Hall, who was then the director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. He had been rather resistant to my working for the RSC. I think he perhaps felt that maybe the work that I'd been doing in television meant that I wasn't quite serious enough to be useful to the company. He took a bit of convincing, but the great thing about it was that when he was convinced, he offered me the whole of the Aldrich season for the coming year and made me an associate immediately. Mm. He didn't wait and see.
Mm.
He showed that once he was convinced, he would take you on in full. Of course, I arrived from... There was something in what he felt. I arrived from ABC television very versed in making things happen.
Hmm.
But perhaps nothing like as versed in deciding what should happen. So I had to learn a great deal at the RSC. You know, if my early upbringing taught me one thing, if my work in television taught me another... And those were very exciting years because we worked so hard and fast and it was all live and it was all very much current and choice. When I went to the RSC, I was asked to take stock of something completely different. And Peter Hall was a very good director of the RSC at that time because he had the courage to have preferences. There was, if you like, an attitude which he imposed on the company.
Mm-hmm.
And within the restrictions of that attitude, you had to work. If you wanted to do something which was not something that he had in mind, you had to argue your case very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first production I did was of All's Well That Ends Well, and I wanted to introduce really strong colour to identify the various parties in the piece. And I had to go to him and say, I'm sorry, I know that you have a rather sub-fusc taste, but I would like to use this colour. I think it has dramatic purpose. And he heard me out and he said, all right, if you want to do that, do it. The implication being, it had better be good. When at Cambridge, I'd worked for the ADC and the Marlowe Society, and I'd done productions of Shakespeare plays at Cambridge, and I'd worked for... I worked for John Barton, who was a very important figure in the RSC. At Cambridge, he was a very important figure. He more or less ran the Cambridge Theatre. At that time, Peter Hall hadn't emerged so much. I remember Peter Hall was Tybalt in a production of Romeo and Juliet I did whilst I was still at Cambridge. By the time I reached the RSC, it was Peter Hall who was preeminent, but John Barton was part of his... organization and directed many very good Shakespearean productions. So, because I was working with John Barton, there was no escaping an increased understanding of the plays.
Mm-hmm.
And I found them, of course, as rich and as captivating as anybody else does. So I found myself immersed in doing the plays of Shakespeare over a period of years. And uncannily, as people do, I found things that had a real bearing on my life in each and every play I did. It was uncanny. Maybe I went through some personal ups and downs, and those personal ups and downs found their echoes in the text in which I was working.
Mm.
I learnt to design costumes as well as sets when I was at Stratford. It being thought there that it was very important that the same person did both.
Mm.
So there would... I mean, it's an act of faith. It's perfectly satisfactory in certain terms for one person to do the sets and another person to do the costumes.
Yes, yeah.
But ideally, it's best if the same person does both.
Yeah.
Because the...
Because of, maybe this goes back to your very point about the enemy's distraction. You have two people working on a production, they've got to be exceptionally sympathetic in terms of each other's work to make it work in a sort of collaboration. I'm sure that there have been many productions where the costumes have outshone the overall design, and vice versa, probably in some maybe West End productions.
Well, if there was any kind of distortion as a result of two different people working on the show, that would be regrettable.
Yeah.
But what I really learned as I worked on these inexhaustibly rich plays was the value and the importance of the director with whom I was working.
Mm.
The relationship between a designer and his director or her director is the paramount relationship.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit later, specifically about the relationship between designer and director, because I think that's quite a rich area. But before we move on to that, I want to deviate a little bit. I think it would be interesting for those listening who are not overly familiar with the process of designing a production from start to finish, would be if you could concisely talk us through how it happens.
Well, mercifully, it's always a little bit different. I think one of the reasons why it's been possible to remain feeling so fresh for more than 50 years is that you're always making fresh starts. All is lost, all has vanished, all is forgiven, now we go again.
Like a newspaper.
Yes, I suppose so, except that a newspaper's content is dictated by external events to a much greater extent.
Yes.
But given these treasures to work on, each time you approach a treasure, you do what Beckett says, which is fail better. I remember realizing how important this process was. And you ask how it feels.
Mm.
Well, first of all, there was in those days an element of excitement, because you knew, because it was a time when the theatre was, in a sense, the classical theatre was really quite stable. You knew that as an associate of the RSC, you would do four productions in the coming season. And the exciting thing was, which is it going to be? And it was like being given a hand to play. In the first year that I worked on Shakespeare there, I did All's Well That Ends Well, As You Like It, Romeo and Juliet, and shortly after that, Troilus and Cressida. And the pleasure of embarking on each of these different texts was extraordinary. So you would be given the play and you would read it, and then you'd go in an entirely open-minded way to talk to the director. And it was often really quite important not to come to it was always very important not to come to a conclusion. You knew what you knew what the theatre expected of you, but this was a particular collaboration, and you would, in a way, tiptoe around the ideas. And I can remember sometimes withholding ideas because I thought they were potentially very good.
They'd be blown, you mean, too early if you released them?
I wanted to create the climate in which these ideas would be inevitably accepted.
It's an interesting nugget.
So, for the people who want to know, if you like, how it's done, you go through this careful dance establishing the way in which the production is going to be done. And then you, as carefully as possible, create the world in which those events can unfold in the form of a model at 1 to 25. So everything is increased in size 25 times to be put on the stage. And you produce a set of costume designs. And you see, if you like, what this blueprint is going to offer the show. And then, in those days, it was quite formal. You used to go with your director and present your ideas to the director of the theatre, Peter Hall, and he would say what he felt about the direction you were taking and how well that direction was realised. Then you would put in train the preparations, the physical preparations for the show, the creation of the scenery and the costumes. And then you would take your designs to meet the cast. And that was always a rather exciting moment, because the cast had to be weaned from the idea that the only thing that was important was what they were going to wear. And you had to say, there is an idea here, you know. Actors, well, you're very volatile, you're quite like chameleons, but there is an idea, and let's take you through it, because you're going to become more and more familiar with this idea until you embody this idea, until you populate the world of the play. And you work very hard to make sure that everything that you've prepared is done as well as possible. And at the same time, you must be prepared to jettison what doesn't work. So you arrive at the stage of putting the show into the theatre. The actors, who have rehearsed extremely well, probably, in the rehearsal room, and have become quite expert and moving in the way they work, suddenly take about five steps backwards, because they encounter the technical process of performing the play in a completely different space. Their costumes are irksome, they trip over the scenery, they're blinded by darkness when the lights are switched off, they're endlessly told to enter again and wait for the music cue. It's a very depressing period. But gradually, each and every part of the production comes together, and you can sense the thing beginning to vibrate and lift. I remember once working in Latvia with a Russian director and saying to one of his associates, "What is he like?" And they said, "He needs a very long runway before he lifts off."
Well, I think that's a lovely description of that whole process, and I think you can feel the excitement brewing up. Well, how long normally were the rehearsal periods for Shakespeare?
They were quite long. Yes.
So they were well bedded in.
So 6 to 8 weeks of rehearsal.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I used to think of shows, ideally produced, as being 6-month efforts. Mm. You could do more than one show at a time. Mm. You could be 4 weeks behind with show two.
Yeah.
And show one and show two will be moving forward in convoy.
Yeah.
But the
time... And so this must have been, I mean, rather like a very special community that you were with.
Yes,
and of course... Creating something very special, followed by something equally as special, a kind of momentum of creativity that's pushing you on.
Alas, I think that this has been replaced by something else, which may be just as valuable, but it's quite different. In those days, there was no national theatre.
Yeah.
There was only a certain amount for television of television for the actors to go and work in. Mm. Consequently, the actors felt that being on board in the Royal Shakespeare Company was a precious and privileged thing, mm. and they wanted to move on year by year into better and better parts until they became leading actors in the mm. company. This sense of continuity was extremely valuable for our work.
Mm.
And now I think everything is very much more one-off. It seems that things are quite responsive to fashion. The personnel change over very quickly. It's not all bad.
What was your... I mean, perhaps you heard recently Jonathan Miller talking on the radio about... the West End Theatre having to be populated by personalities, and that his own production, I think, of Macbeth, which had received, I think, very good reviews in the North somewhere, is not being transferred to London. And his view was simply that it had a young actor that was not a movie star or a television star, and that's all that theatre wants these days because of the commercial pressure.
Yes, there have always been commercial pressures in the commercial theatre.
Yes.
The commercial pressures may take a different form if the solution that is to hand mm. is a prominence on television, for example.
Mm. Well, actually, on that, let's just touch on that, because I want to talk about Evita, which was an enormous success, and obviously an enormous success for you, because it's continued to be performed around the world, and I assume very much with your blueprint.
The productions, it was a great success initially. It was a great success here, and it was a great success in America. And at one point, there was a company playing it here, and there were four companies playing it in America, and there was a company playing it in South Africa, and a company playing it in Australia, and a company playing it in New Zealand, a company playing it in Germany, and so on and so on.
But that must be manna from heaven for a designer.
It's the only way a designer can ever put a little bit by.
Yes.
Otherwise, and the people who listen to our interview who are thinking of going to the theatre might take note that it's sometimes perfectly acceptable to work for 6 months for £5,000.
Mm.
But Evita did make a considerable difference.
Sure.
Whilst it lasted. And it lasted in one form or another, tapering off gradually, certainly until about... It opened in 79, and it was still being produced in our version in, say, 94, 95, 96. So that's nearly 20 years
that's
of life, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, I want to go back now to something we touched on earlier, and that's the relationship between designer and the director. And I say this because, I mean, you've worked with some very eminent directors. You've already mentioned Peter Hall, and there's David Jones and Peter Wood. And Pinter, I know not often, but Pinter was another playwright and director that you worked with. And Graham Vick, of course, who you're currently working with. But there's one director that stands out in your list of productions, and that's Terry Hands, for whom you've actually worked on 19 productions, more than any other director in your span. What has made that particular relationship so enduring? What is it about working with him that clearly works?
Well, first of all, it's, I think, right to say that when I first worked with Terry Hands, I worked with him continuously for a little while, and then I turned something down that he offered me. And there was a very long gap. And then much later on, we worked together again. And I sometimes think that those 19 productions could have been 40 productions if I hadn't turned down Richard III. But let's go back to what he's like. Well, when I first worked with him, he was very young. I could probably work it out. But he was probably about 26, and I was, let me think, I'm 15 years older than he is, I think.
Okay, so you're into your late 30s.
I was in my late 30s. I remember him saying to me once when we had been through a costume plot, he said, "Do you think at your age you're capable of holding this in your head?" And I said something quite unkind to him in return. But the thing about him was that when we first worked with him, we were doing The Merry Wives of Windsor, a play which had not a very good stage history at that time. It had been put on a number of times. It had never really worked. And the thing I really admired about this young director was that he studied both the play and the world from which the play sprang. It's the one play of Shakespeare's which is rather like a bourgeois situation comedy. And he really studied the community out of which the play had sprung. And he took it extremely seriously. He played it, quite a funny play, he played it extremely seriously and took it really seriously. And as a result, it was immensely entertaining and immensely convincing. Mm. Everybody before that had tried to have fun with it. I remember there was a disastrous production designed by the Frenchman André François.
Oh, yes, of course. A very well-known illustrator.
Yes, and I mean, just shows. You shouldn't do a Shakespeare play if what you're going to do is to turn it into something which has a one-note appeal.
Yeah.
Because the plays are so sucky. Anyway, Terry worked on that production so carefully that when it came to the stage, it had a radiance which was completely unexpected. It was very funny, but it was also very touching, very radiant, very interesting, very, very comforting as a play.
Mm.
And then he worked very hard again on Pericles, Prince of Tyre, another play which is not very much done. And again, it has a great deal of Neoplatonic content, and he went into the Neoplatonism very carefully, and we took immense pains over it, and we produced a piece of work on the Stratford stage which was quite spare, quite full of emblems, very clear in its narrative drive, and because we took it so seriously, once again, touching.
Mm.
So I had a great deal of time for him, and it's a pity, maybe, that I made the mistake of turning down Richard III, because there might have been quite a lot more productions of great interest at that time.
Mm.
And I came back to him in, I think it was 91, when I did Love's Labour's Lost at Stratford with Jenny, my wife, who helped me on that production. That was really good. A very long layoff had refreshed the ground, and it was a production that I very much enjoyed designing, because Terry said to me, I'm quite interested in what you think about the colour green. And I said, well, I tell you what I think. I think we'll go away and I'll design a set and we'll see what you think. And what I did was I designed a set which in form was quite straightforward. It was a rolling stage, that is to say undulating floor, with a fair number of trees on the stage. And the trees were in leaf. But I thought of Seurat and Signac, and I got someone to paint three or four different colours on every leaf, on every tree.
Oh, my goodness.
And I painted the backcloth you saw beyond the trees.
So you had this stipple effect, sort of pointillist effect.
Pointillist, yeah. And divisionist, and the backcloth that lay beyond the trees, I painted in exactly the same way. Colours set side by side, adding in vibration to one another.
Yes, yes.
So when you saw the set on the stage, you were convinced that nature had been restated in a way which was completely accessible, but was also vibrating rather than stationary.
Yes, I can see that because of the pairing of colours to give it that.
Mm.
That sounds terrific. So, just moving on, I want to sort of move away slightly from your day job and just talk a little bit about the very thing that you came up with whilst you were master at the Faculty of Royal Designers, and that's the summer school, which is going to be this year, and it's eighth year. And I just wanted to just talk a little bit about your thinking behind that.
Well, the principal point, and I can't take all the credit for the creation of the summer school, Chris Wise, the current master, and I met back in 1999 in the kitchen of the house in which I was then living, and I said that I felt that the Faculty of Royal Designers for Industry were not only deservedly not very well known, but also coming into a group of designers like that from the cold, if you like. Theatre designers don't really meet other kinds of designers. When I was at the BBC, Richard Levin, who had a background in the Festival of Britain, had introduced me to designers of other kinds. But once I left the BBC and went to ABC Television and then to the RSC and then into a freelance theatre career, I found myself happy but very isolated. So when I was elected an RDI, I found myself once again in the company of designers of all kinds. And I thought that this was very exciting. Or I thought it was potentially very exciting. But I found that there was a kind of circular quality to their in a discourse. They talked to each other and they said the same thing over and over and over again. And they really didn't do anything very much. And so I thought of my enthusiasm for the faculty rather like a full-blown tulip, really nice to look at, but the petals started falling off with quiet thuds as time went by. I was very surprised to be asked to be the master of the faculty. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity to re-examine the Faculty of Royal Designers for Industry. Maybe not go so far as to redesign the faculty, but to re-examine it. And I felt that there was a substantial minority that maybe felt as I did and wanted to do something interesting with such an interesting group of people. And I also felt that there should be a constituency, that we had to have a constituency, that we weren't enough just on our own. And I saw that constituency as being other designers, many of whom would be younger than we were. And I was in the kitchen with Chris and I said, well, I think we should just be rather piratical about this. We should just go around the degree shows at the end of the year and we should just dish out the price of a meal for two to anybody we like. So they would at least be grateful to us. They could take their girlfriend off to a restaurant and have a really good meal and say, well, that came from the Faculty of Royal Designers for Industry. I didn't know about them last week, but I sure know about them now. And he said, well, maybe we could think of an activity. And in the course of the conversation, we came up with the idea of the summer school. Well, of course, then the fact of the matter was that I had to raise the money. So I was very fortunate. The Design Council gave us a really large sum of money to let us get going. And I thought that the whole process of putting on the summer school was a very exciting thing and concentrated one because there suddenly seemed to be a purpose to it. And I think the purpose was to take people out of their everyday lives and, as I said at the time, to enable them to return to their everyday lives and push back the corridor walls of their everyday lives so that they would actually feel more in possession of themselves, more capable of running their lives, more capable of doing what they actually wanted to do. I was very aware at that time, it wasn't surprising, that one was very aware of the hold that the market had over every aspect of life.
Mm.
And I minded about that.
Mm.
And so I felt, well, let there be each year created 30 people who don't see the market as an ideal, but see their own wishes, their own hopes, and the realization of their own gifts as the ideal.
Well, I mean, having been to many myself and witnessed the effect that it has on many of the younger designers, and indeed the more mature designers, I would totally agree with that. I think it does give one opportunity to re-examine one's own role in all of this. We've got to round off now, so just a last couple of questions. Next year is going to be a rather special year for you, in that it's not only your eighth decade, but you will have completed the ring cycle for Graham Vix production, which is Gotha Dameron. I believe it's called Twilight of the Gods, and I think it's to have completed that. It's kind of the theatre designer's equivalent of playing Lear, I should think. So, what is getting to that point in your life, and it's a long professional life. What has design meant to you over all those years of practicing it?
Well, of course, design has meant different things at different times. My notion of what it is has evolved. I like to think that it's evolved for the better. Possibly what I was talking about at the very beginning about virtue, that disposition towards harmony, health, beauty and strength, is important. What I think you always want to do is to return to the things that are precious to you. The theatre is a privileged place in which the plight of living can be examined without a penalty. The theatre is a prism through which you can see the world. You're given these examples without risk, where you can examine the nature of things. Fortunately, you can do this with means which are very ordinary. What you have to engage is your imagination. And the imagination, I believe, is the means by which we relate to the world. So my design work has been at the service of an evolving understanding, which it has been, well, it has been tremendously important to me. It doesn't matter whether I've been a good designer or a bad designer. The actual process has enriched me enormously. Of course, it's risky. It's not risky in many ways, but it's very risky because you can make mistakes. You can lose sight of what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'm asked by people who are interested in what to do with their lives, what the process perhaps of living a life is like. And I sometimes come up with the image of a piano with all its keys stuck. And when you're young, there's the piano, the keys are all stuck, and what you have to do is you have to unstick the keys. The more keys you unstick, the more you can say, the more you can express yourself. And you maybe do quite well, and you unstick the majority of the keys, and you can begin to make music. Then, of course, there's always the chance that as you get older, and you've just spilt the beans and said, I'm going to be 80 next year, you might find the keys start sticking again. And you must work very hard that those keys don't stick again. You should try and end with as many keys still working as you can possibly manage. That's the sort of thing that I would say if I was asked a really difficult question like, what's the point? I would say, that was the point. So I just think that designing for the theatre has been the medium for living and the medium for understanding the act of living.
Well, on one last point now, there may well be some young hopefuls out there who want to follow in your footsteps in theatre design. And you've already let one little nugget out of the bag, which is don't show your hand too early, which I thought was a very good one. Do you have anything else that you might like to pass on?
Well, I've heard you ask this question of some of your interviewees, and mostly they say that you've got to take it seriously, you've got to work really hard. And I believe in that. Because if you're going to spend your time designing for the theatre, you're going to be having a life which is more unpredictable and potentially richer than most lives which are lived to a pattern. And the responsibility, I think, is to work out what is important to yourself and live in the light of that. And I always remember there's a line in Lear,
How appropriate.
Which says that he says, and take upon us the mystery of things, as if we were God's spies.
On that note, Timothy O'Brien, thank you very much.
RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.